Eli Dorado is an economist, researcher, and writer. His essays have been published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. He is currently a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. Eli, welcome to The Splinter.
Great to be with you.
So Eli, as some of our listeners will know at this point, the idea of stagnation in the economy has become sort of a recurring theme in this series of conversations. And I have to say, it's one of these slippery concepts that, on one hand, is really difficult to convince people of, and on the other, feels totally obvious in hindsight. Once you experience a sort of light bulb moment, you can't help but see evidence of stagnation everywhere you look. And I think part of the challenge in communicating the essence of the idea is that growth in the economy is really hard to measure. And in that sense in particular, I think you've made a major contribution to the conversation in the way that you've introduced so-called total factor productivity to a general audience. And so I'd love to start there. What is total factor productivity, and why do you feel like it's the right measure of progress for society?
Yeah, so conceptually, total factor productivity is the growth that you get while holding like resources constant, right? So it's like, you know, you can have growth for a number of reasons. Like, we could all just decide to work longer hours, right? And we'd have higher GDP, right? Or we could save more, right? We could consume less and we could apply more capital to production, right? And then the other way you can increase growth is without applying any more resources, but just having better like recipes, better like, you know, like technological and social recipes for producing output with the same amount of inputs. And that's what that's what I consider to be like more like fundamental economic growth, and that's what TFP tries to estimate. And it's basically, I mean, the way it's calculated is just basically you take growth and you figure out, you know, how much is due to labor and capital, and whatever you can't explain with labor and capital, that's what we consider TFP. So it's like a residual. It's like what's left over after accounting for all the other inputs that we can try to measure.
And what does that residual consist of?
It's just unexplained variation in the amount of growth, right? So it's literally like the standard way to do this is you know, you run a regression and then what you can't explain is TFP, and then you just do like sort of growth accounting going forward of like, well, we saw this much increase in labor and this much increase in capital, but we saw this much increase in output, and if we can't explain it by labor and capital, then it's got to be something else.
I've heard it described that residual. I've heard it described as being either technology or institutions. Is that an oversimplification?
I think it's a combination of both of those things. Yeah, I think it's over like a very long period of time. If you think about like why we're wealthier than society was 200 years ago, it's obviously because we know how to do more things. We have better ideas. We have science. We have all kinds of technological recipes for things. But then if you think about like why is the US wealthier than Venezuela? It's like the ideas aren't that different, right? It's like mostly the same ideas available in Venezuela and the US. And like, so why is the US wealthier applying the same amount of capital and labor? It's because the quality in these institutions is higher. So I think there's also cases like, and Venezuela is an example, but like other cases, like more moderate cases, like even Italy over the last 20 years, where TFP has gone down over the last 20 years. And it's not because they forgot ideas. It's because probably the quality of the institutions have declined. So it's both. You need both parts of the story to have a complete picture.
And so what's the normal level of TFP growth in the economy, and what are we at today?
Well, it depends what you consider to be a normal period, right? So the sort of heyday for TFP growth was 1920 to early 1970s, like 1973 is sometimes cited as the cutoff. That was on the order of 2% a year, total factor productivity growth, like year after year. And then, there was a sort of a change that we now call the Great Stagnation, that since then the growth has been slower. It was briefly almost as high again in like mid 1995 to 2005, let's say. It was about 2% again. But it was from, you know, so if you take the 1973 to 1995 period, is about 0.5%. So like a fell by like the annual rate growth rate fell by like 75%, right? So it was like a quarter of what it was. And then since 2005, it's been abysmal. It's been like 0.3% per year. So like cumulatively, like 6% growth in the US, 6.something% growth since 2005. So pretty bad, pretty abysmal. That would have been like 3 years growth, right? In sort of like the middle of last century.
And what do you think the slight increase that happened in the mid 1990s is attributable to? Is it, you know, novel IT technologies? Is it the reopening of China in the global economy? What do you think explains it?
Those are the two like major explanations. It's like, okay, like you didn't need the, you could like word processing, email, and like those kinds of innovations. And I think insofar as they like let you have fewer employees, basically, right? You no longer need someone to like type up your own stuff if you have a word processing capability. Trade with China has been obviously is a huge thing, right? The way to think about that is like, wait, we outsource the stuff that we were not especially productive at to China, and that leaves the stuff that we are more productive at, right? Like a lot of the design stuff we are the best in the world at. So we're kind of like shipping off our low value add stuff and keeping the high value add stuff, and that raises our productivity. And so those two things, I think, probably account for it. I don't have a very defined like empirical view of like what percent breakdown it was. But what's interesting to me also, though, is that obviously like computers have continued to get better since 2005, and we've had the smartphone era, and we, you know, all of a sudden, and like the growth has been abysmal since then. So it's not like any kind of IT helps you move forward. It's only like IT that lets you replace jobs, basically. that's how you actually grow TFP, is like replace an entire employee with like, you know, simple program or something like that.
Gotcha. Does the world need a TFP futures market?
I think it would be really great for thinking about like some of these AI questions, right? Because you have all kinds of views on AI, right? And some people think, you know, it's going to kill us all. Some people think it's going to, you know, shepherd in this like glorious era of like post-scarcity. And then I think other people think it's not going to do anything at all. And we don't really have a way of betting directly on that. But if the financial markets, you know, I think it would be a pretty liquid market to have a TFP futures market. And we could actually like infer what the markets are thinking about that. If you look at other things that do exist, right, like bets on future interest rates and stuff like that, it doesn't seem like markets are pricing in like a big AI boom, you know, big economically significant boom right now. So we'll see. But I think a TFP, I would just like to see people bet on TFP, because the more salient that is, the better from my perspective.
In my experience, people are initiated into the topic of economic stagnation by reading one of two books, Peter Thiel's 0-1 or The Great Stagnation by Tyler Cowen, your former PhD advisor. So needless to say, you know Tyler better than most. He's an extremely well-respected economist, thinker, and blogger, and he's also a well-known Straussian. In an essay you wrote back in 2011, you said that, quote, "The Great Stagnation is a sober, moderate take on our current economic troubles, except that it's not. Straight out of Persecution and the Art of Writing, it's a book designed to appeal to the sane, honest middle of American politics. But for the careful, enlightened reader, there's a hidden and radical message. The time is ripe for an anarchist revolution." What exactly are the aspects of the book that you found to be so subversive?
That was just me. I thought it was funny. As I was reading the book, there are some things where, you know, Tyler was writing about, you know, the sane, honest middle and several times, and he like repeated it enough times that I was like, wait, does he really think this, right? And I just sort of kind of went from there and I was like, well, let's say if we were going to do a Straussian reading, what would it look like? And that post was the result. And it was just, you know, good fun. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how much I even believe. I don't know how much I believe it. I don't know that I disbelieve it. But it was a tongue-in-cheek post that I think had nuggets of truth in it.
In your essay, you also write later in the conclusion that Cowan warns us to, quote, be ready for when more low-hanging fruit arrives. And it strikes me that there's sort of been a resurgence of interest in the topic of deep tech or hard tech, especially in VC circles. Do you think that's what he was referring to when he mentioned the return of low-hanging fruit? Getting back to building in the world of atoms as opposed to the world of bits?
I think that's what it would have to take, right? I think one of the ways I think about this is Robert Gordon wrote a piece on the great inventions. And if you think about what happened in the middle of the 20th century that made it a really special time, was that there were five great inventions that were deployed kind of all at the same time, right? And it was like electrification, the internal combustion engine, the automobile, telecommunications, telephone, television, applied chemistry, things like pharmaceuticals and plastics and other things like that. And then like urban sanitation. So all the sewage systems that allowed us to live much more sanitary conditions. And if you think about those five things all hitting at once, essentially, they're all kind of invented in the late 1800s, but then really scaled up in terms of their deployment, like kind of all at the same time. And so we had like five great inventions. And then if you kind of fast forward to, today, I don't know when you want to date it, but like 1980s to today, we've had one great invention, right? Like computers and the internet and IT, right? And so if you want a sort of return to growth, you need more than one, right? And it's got to be something like, on the order of five. And so that means, we can maybe have continued digital growth, but it's got to be like digital growth combined with like four other big things. I think it's got to be more industrial stuff.
When I think of stagnation in terms of specific technologies, supersonic commercial aviation is the first thing that comes to mind because it was a reality in the 1970s, but was somehow lost along the way. Earlier in your career, you worked for Boom Supersonic, a startup that's trying to reverse that trend and get us back to the future. And your job title there was a really unique and interesting one, regulatory hacker. What does it mean to hack regulation, and what was your day-to-day like during your time at Boom?
Well, so that was not my job title at Boom, but that is kind of like what I called myself, especially looking back on it. But I was head of global policy and global communications, first of all, I was just like so grateful for the opportunity to do that. I mean, I kind of, one of the great things about spending some time at a startup is that the startups just give people enormous scope, right? And so if I was coming in at a sort of, in a comparable role at another airplane company or something like that, an established airplane company, it would have been like four levels down, right? And so, so being able to like have a role with enormous scope was just, it was like perfect for where I was at in my career. My day-to-day job there, I would say 80 to 90% of it was dealing with one issue, which was landing and takeoff noise. So it was, how loud can the airplane be when it takes off? And this is a very like controversial topic. There's lots of people who live near airports who get very upset if there's too much noise. And we've had through a series of innovations, we've had noise reduction in subsonic airplanes, but you can't apply all those same techniques to supersonic aviation, right? And the basic reason is that the way they've reduced noise in subsonic aviation is they've made the engines wider, basically, and more bypass air around the core. And if you have a big wide engine while you're flying at supersonic cruise, you're going to have a ton of drag, and that is going to wreck your fuel burn for cruise, and so you're paying for it the whole flight, even though you're get quieter noise like during takeoff and landing, which is a short period of time. So a big chunk of my time was like dealing with a little bit with FAA, but also a lot internationally. There's a UN organization called ICAO that does standards for international aviation, including environmental standards and including takeoff noise. So, spent a lot of time like on technical committees and sort of, advocating for like a reasonable approach to, that took into account all the trade-offs that affect supersonic flight. And so trying to come up with new standards and trying to get support for those new standards.
It's striking to me that the so-called regulatory hacker job is the kind of job that would be incredibly impactful, but only in certain industries, because it kind of requires this Goldilocks zone where working to unravel and fully understand regulation is both possible and worthwhile. So, for example, if it's just a fact that regulation around nuclear energy is too onerous, then maybe it's not the right place for startups to spend their time. And conversely, if you're working on regulation in, say, consumer electronics, and that means that you get to sell iPhones that are 5 grams lighter, that doesn't really move the needle. So I guess my question is, first, do you agree with that? And second, can you think of other industries that, like commercial aviation, would be good candidates for regulatory hacking?
I think anything that is primarily sort of a physical world thing where there's environmental or safety issues, like there's a lot of solutions that can be had in a lot of places, even nuclear, right? I don't think we've fully explored the space of ideas for either deregulating or loopholes or whatever. There's still to be had, and kind of one of the things I like to do in my current role is kind of dig in and try to find stuff like that. But I would say like most people are not trying to do those things. Most people are, content to be like nuclear bros on Twitter and just say like, yeah, the NRC should get out of the way without like dealing with specifics. Right. And you gotta really dive into the weeds if you want to be constructive and be part of it. And, very, very often it's only people in industry or a very small number of people in the sort of nonprofit sector that are kind of working on this stuff.
Continuing with the topic of energy, in a paper you co-authored with Austin Vernon last year called Energy Superabundance, you describe what life would be like in a world with endless energy, writing that, quote, if our society remains suspicious of high energy expenditures, at least part of the reason is a lack of vision of what we might realistically do with superabundant energy. This paper aims to supply that vision. There's a lot to unpack there, but can you share a quick snapshot of that vision for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So we think Austin and I kind of both thought a lot of what we would spend the energy on is further transportation, right? So many, many more vehicle miles traveled. A lot of those are going to be sort of unmanned bots, like just delivering stuff around, doing sort of logistics stuff. So instead of like one UPS delivery truck driven by a human that does a route or whatever, you could have, sidewalk bots or drones taking packages and sort of autonomously delivering them all over the place. And obviously, if you have many more vehicles, even if they're lower energy use per vehicle, right? But if you have many, many more vehicles, then that's going to be a lot more energy. And then, you know, so it's like cargo, but then also humans, right? And like supersonic flight would be an example of like, well, we need a lot of energy, you know, especially if we want to do it in a zero carbon way, to take atmospheric CO2 and convert it into a liquid hydrocarbon that you can use in a supersonic jet, and then maybe a hypersonic jet, and you know, go to Tokyo for lunch or whatever. That, you know, traveling around faster is a big part of that. And then a lot of the other stuff that we were really interested in was materials. So things like, you know, cement and plastics and desalination of water and, you know, just providing resources in better ways, in sort of negative carbon ways, addressing things like drought by just applying a whole lot of energy to the problem and the problem's kind of basically solved. So and then I think a few other things were like agriculture, right? Like indoor farming, you know, vertical farms. You could, right now we're only really trying to do it with a few very delicate kinds of plants, but you could, you know, as the cost of energy goes down, you could see it like walking down a curve where we get more and more stuff in, you know, initially greenhouses, but then eventually like vertical farms. There's a lot of, there'll be a lot of uses for energy if it gets a lot more abundant and a lot cheaper.
Achieving energy superabundance requires that we first develop new methods of energy production that are globally scalable and cheap. But energy strikes me as a really tough market because on one side, it requires major technical breakthroughs, and on the other, energy as a good is totally commoditized. Among the different technologies that you've surveyed in this field, are there some that you feel might have an edge when it comes to commercialization specifically?
Well, so I'll push back a little bit, right? So energy is like not as commoditized as you think, right? There's like a bunch of different kinds of energy. So there's, you can think about there's mechanical energy and there's thermal energy and there's electrical energy, right? And then within that, right, like say within thermal energy, there's high temperature and low temperature. And so it's not really just a quantity of energy that you want. You want it delivered at the right temperature. And then there's things like portability, right? How portable is this energy? And then there's questions of like, well, how reliable is it? Or how, you know, is it firm versus intermittent? And if it's intermittent, like how predictable is it over a longer period? And if it's firm, is it load following or is it not load following? And so there's actually like a bunch of different kinds of energy that we consume. And, you know, I think, so we will always have a mix of things not just on the grid, but in our energy mix in general. And there's a lot of stuff that I would like to have that would help. So probably the cheapest source of like electrons, or you know, like if you just want electricity, and you're not too fussy about the other requirements, would be something like solar, right? Like, so I think like one of the things that we like about solar panels is they're solid state. They're manufacturable. Like they come down in cost. There's a learning rate that you know happens as you scale up. And so like I think solar panels will be like for a long time like the cheapest source of electrons. You know, if you want, think about like a bunch of other applications. Like if you're warming a greenhouse or like running a paper mill, and a paper mill operates on something like 150 degree C steam, like geothermal is like a really good option, right? And so there's so much of it available on the planet, and then all we need is improvements in drilling and in subsurface engineering to get access to it, and then you got that, and you know there's we've th- that technology comes out of the shale fields where, you know, we've kind of had huge reductions in sort of the cost of fracking and of accessing natural gas. And if we kind of have the same kinds of reductions in the cost of geothermal for like those applications, then all of a sudden it's like starts getting interesting for electricity production, particularly if you can access, you know, steam that's like 500 degrees C or so, you can have supercritical water. And then that starts getting interesting from a repowering of power plants perspective. And then I think like the other piece that I would really, really love to see in my lifetime is like very small nuclear. So like portable nano reactors, right? Like in the, you know, 30 to 300 kilowatt range, electric, or maybe, you know, up to a megawatt or more thermal. But those small, like shipping container sized nuclear reactors that are, you know, I think they would fill like a really, really great, gap in the current system. And then I think a lot in terms of like, what can we do that would economize on transmission too, right? And so being able to have like these, you know, kind of smaller units that you can put anywhere would limit the need to build out like a ton of transmission, you know, kind of everywhere in the country.
A little later in the paper, you write that, quote, ultimately, our goal in promoting abundant energy is faster economic growth and higher standards of living. The relationship between economic growth and energy consumption runs in both directions. Richer countries demand more energy in virtue of being wealthier and therefore are able to afford more energy. But careful econometric research has shown that the causality runs the other way as well. Higher energy consumption directly increases economic growth. Can you untangle that last bit? What's the major advantage when it comes to energy consumption as it relates to economic growth?
I think the way I would think about that is just it's you know, when you have energy scarcity, you're really limited in, you know, a lot of times what you would do is revert to sort of muscle, right? Muscle, biological energy, like mediated through, you know, animal muscles, or you just like wouldn't do the thing, right? So either you have like a horse plowing a field again, or you don't, or you just decide not to be an aluminum producer, right? And you just can't do the thing. So it's, I would just look at it as like energy is like one of the most important resources that we use in production. And there's like, you know, if you kind of think about TFP as like a collection of recipes that we can use, it's TFP, like a lot of those recipes call for energy as an input. And if you're really limited in the inputs that you have available, then you can't use all the recipes that are in that recipe book.
Continuing on that last point in particular, I'd like to recycle a question that I originally asked Ben Reinhart when he appeared on the podcast. Today, I think that most people interested in progress studies would agree generally that energy superabundance is a goal worth pursuing. And in your work, as we've discussed, you've done a great job at outlining the most promising innovations that might get us there, from nuclear energy to ultra-deep geothermal to modern batteries and beyond. But at the margin, I'm curious about the degree to which people agree on the relative importance of energy abundance, especially in relation to other concerns like climate change and pollution. In a recent interview, Peter Thiel touched on this idea when he said that, quote, the world consumes about 100 million barrels of oil a day. And if given a choice, do we go to 110 or do we go to 90? Surely the world in which we go to 110 is better than the world in which we go to 90. Do you agree with that? How urgent is the need to ramp up energy intensity, not contingent on some major breakthrough, but in today's world with today's constraints?
I mean, I think, you know, like so, sort of like a sober look at the data would show like, okay, the world's not going to end if we marginally increase our oil consumption, right? So I think there's a narrow interpretation of what Peter says that makes sense to me. You know, however, I do think, you know, over some longer term, like you have to deal with climate, and the way you deal with climate is not, it's not going to work to just like moralize people into like, well, you're being a bad human by consuming a lot of carbon. What you have to do is create the, you have to create the super cheap, you know, zero carbon energy or low carbon energy that makes it in everybody's incentive, you know, gives them the incentive to adopt the low carbon technology that will, you know, will enable, you know, simultaneously, you know, emissions reductions and energy abundance. So I kind of don't see it as an option to basically reduce emissions without energy abundance, right? It's going to be absolutely necessary if you want to reduce energy, carbon emissions. You've got to find clean sources that are, you know, if not today, like over the long run, that are super cheap, right? And if you don't do that, like it's not going to work. So that's probably like how I would differ with Peter, is just say like, just thinking about from the perspective of like, what is the incentive compatible way to like reduce carbon emissions? It's like, well, you got to have abundance.
Space is another sector that you've written about and identified as something that's especially promising. It's a field that obviously captures the imagination, but sometimes even the most dedicated space nerds struggle to put into words the tangible benefits that come from investments in space. You've outlined a few in an essay called Why Go to Space, including satisfying humanity's need for a frontier, improvements to daily life here on Earth through things like GPS and satellite communications, benefits to science and research, and one final area, protecting and preserving democracy. Can you say more about that last category?
Yeah, I think we've known for a long time, right, military theory, that you want to occupy the high ground. And, you know, orbit is the highest ground on Earth, right? Like being able to have assets that are, you know, whizzing around up there, and sort of being able to be called upon at a moment's notice to, you know, be part of, you know, military action, I think is very important. A lot of that is like surveillance type stuff, right? So we've seen like, sort of in the first, especially the opening gambits of the Ukraine war, like how critical satellite intelligence was to Ukrainian forces, right? Like being able to effectively like use US data to understand like where the Russians were coming and what was going on with them was super important. But in the long run, I think like space-based weapons are going to be, they think right now it's kind of a taboo to think about, but it's pretty inevitable that it will happen. And, you know, we've seen also efforts by lots of countries to, notably China and Russia, to demonstrate anti-satellite missiles and stuff like that. And of course, the U.S. has that capability too, and actually much to a much greater extent. And it's going to be a very important military space in the coming century.
We started our conversation by talking about TFP and how it's a proxy measure for the quality of both our tech and our institutions. We've covered tech, and now I'd like to shift the conversation over to institutions. Last year, Stripe Press republished a memoir by Vannevar Bush called Pieces of the Action. You reviewed the book, saying that, quote, "Pieces of the Action is not just about science and innovation. It's about state capacity. Anyone who longs for renewed, effective institutions will find the wisdom of a kindred spirit reflecting on how to build them." What did you mean by state capacity in that review, and how can modern countries foster more of it?
I mean, I remember reading, Bush's thoughts, and it was just all about like, how can we get this agency to like do the job that it's supposed to do, right? And he was just thinking very hard about these questions, and so yeah, I think like state capacity is just, I guess I would define it as the ability of the government to function, to function well, in light of sort of the fundamental problem that agencies have is that, like, their governance is kind of a common pool resource, right? Like in the sense that, like, if they are kind of bad at their job, like, everyone kind of suffers, like, a little bit, but not really. There's nobody who suffers so much that they're like take on the role of fixing it, right? And so, there is like, running an agency well is a public good, in and of itself, and we certainly saw. I think there's this era, you know, in World War II and the era right after it, where there were some very talented people in government who were very serious about trying to make the agencies work well, and Bush was one of those. And you know, again, it, like, coincides with, like, the high growth era in the mid-century. And I'm sure there are very smart people who work at, you know, very senior people at agencies. You know, I've met some of them that do a good job, but I don't think people are thinking through in sort of a first principles way, you know, how to make these systems work well. I think they're mainly thinking about, like, okay, I've inherited this, like, you know, huge organization, and it's got, like, all these flaws, and I'm just going to try to keep the whole thing running in light of the problems and constraints that we currently face. And but thinking it through on, like, a first principles level is probably what we need in a lot of cases.
So if you think back to the institutions as they were described by Vannevar Bush and look at those same institutions today, are there differences there that you would highlight that you think are especially important? So we've talked about talent already and the question of, are there talented people in these institutions thinking about how to improve them from a first principles perspective? But are there structural issues that you would highlight in specific institutions?
I mean, yeah. So even some of the institutions that Bush, you know, worked on and set up, like, have gotten more cautious over time. You know, our science institutions, like, his sort of view is that, like, they should be basically centralized. I think that has not stood the test of time. And today we need to be thinking about how do we maybe have competing structures within government, where, you know, instead of giving, you know, however many billion dollars we give to the NIH and, you know, letting them sort of divide the pie, like, what if we had competing NIHs or something, where if one of them did, you know, was getting better results, like, okay, we increase the budget for that one and decrease the budget for the other one. You kind of can't do that today, but I think that would probably be better if we had some sort of institutional competition at, you know, on as many levels as we can within the government.
And so if state capacity is the ability of states to achieve their goals, how should we think about state capacity in the context of globalization? Would you say that China has greater state capacity than the United States, or not necessarily?
I would say they have very high state capacity on some issues, right? So like if they want to build, if you want to build something in China, like infrastructure that, you know, government projects or whatever, like, they can absolutely do that. I think they've put out like 42,000 kilometers of high speed rail since 2008, right? And the US has very few, and I think the only one in the US that's entered service is like a private company in Florida. So that's like an example of like high Chinese state capacity. But I think that sort of when you get into like softer questions, right? Like of like, how do you develop like a world leading science sector or something like that, right? Like the US is still like way ahead, and there's not a lot that China can do about it for like reasons like nobody wants to immigrate to China, right? Like no scientists, like if you're a non-Chinese scientist, you don't aspire to move to China and like go contribute to their science system. In part that's because, you know, China is notoriously racist and not accepting of foreigners and so on. People do want to go to the US. So like that's, I think, an example of, you know, sort of incomplete state capacity in China. And I think that applies to a lot of things. So sort of like China has tried very hard to have an aerospace sector that is, has caught up, a semiconductor sector that has caught up to the West. They're still dependent on energy imports, despite, you know, they could do fracking there. There's no reason, like they have tons of land. I'm sure there's some natural gas and oil there, and they haven't done it. So there's a lot of holes in sort of Chinese state capacity.
Well, regardless of how it's measured, I think it's clear that political dysfunction in the US has reached all-time highs. You've written about the promise and sort of the urgency of voting reforms as a possible escape hatch from the current culture wars. Before we dive into the potential solutions, what are the main problems with the current voting system? And in particular, how does it encourage political extremism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem with the first past the post voting system is that it's basically a two-party system. It's like the idea of having like more than one party or more than two parties is it's unstable, right? It's like an unstable equilibrium. And because the third party is always going to play a spoiler, have a spoiler effect in a first past the post system. And, you know, two parties worked fine when you had very strong parties that were very motivated to sort of win at all costs in the general election, right? And today, paradoxically, we have much weaker parties where neither party is really staking out the moderate ground. And therefore, you have a much stronger culture war that exists because the stakes in the elections are much higher in terms of sort of the cultural ground that's going to be occupied by the ruling party. And so the culture war is just like way more detrimental now and way hotter than it ever was before. Whereas, you know, kind of if you had like sort of just like a plain median voter, straightforward median voter hypothesis, right? Like you would have both parties like basically being indistinguishable from each other. Like one is like epsilon to the right, one is epsilon to the left. And the voter just chooses, do you want like the slightly right or slightly left one? And that's like all you get to decide between. And that would work. But that's not what we have anymore, because they've sort of, the parties themselves have lost control over the nominating process, and so the candidates are a little crazier on both sides.
And so when it comes to alternative voting methods, what are your favorites and how would you rate the likelihood of their adoption?
Yeah, so like my all-time favorite is like a Condorcet model, right, where you are, you know, kind of the voter ranks all the candidates in order of like preference. And then, you know, you can imagine like the entity whose job it is to count the votes, they just like pairwise compare like every two candidates and be like, okay, if these were the only two candidates, who would win? And then, you know, you'd have a system where if there was one candidate that was undefeated in sort of pairwise comparison, then obviously that candidate wins. And if there was, if more likely, you know, especially if you have a lot of parties, more likely that there's more than one candidate that's part of like an undefeated set where they might have there some cycling in terms of elections between them. But then outside of that set, like they defeat every candidate outside of that set. And so then you'd need some other tie-breaking method sort of between candidates in that set. And you could pick a bunch of things. I like approval voting. So that would just modify the system so that when you go to rank all your candidates, on your ballot, you just draw a line somewhere and say, I approve of the candidates above this line. I disapprove of the candidates below this line. And then the most approved candidate would win in the event of like, you know, where there's a circularity or ambiguity in the will of the people. And so I think that what I like about this sort of idea is it just encourages moderation, right? Because what you want is to have the widest possible appeal, not necessarily to be like the intense favorite of like a tiny minority. If we had candidates all like trying to be, have really, really wide appeal, I think that would be a lot better for the country.
And how would you rate the likelihood of these kinds of reforms being adopted?
So like, you know, that ideal, like for me, voting method seems very, very unlikely. Although, you know, maybe somebody could try it, right? Like some city could implement it, maybe. I don't know. But what has already passed in a bunch of places is, you know, what's called ranked choice voting. Of course, my method is also a ranked choice model, but like what they mean by ranked choice voting is some sort of instant runoff. So where you take, you know, the voter ranks the candidates, and then you know, you take all the first choice picks of all the candidates, you tally those up, whoever finishes last gets eliminated, then you retally it again with first picks only of remaining candidates. Again, you strike the last place one until you do that over and over again until you have a winner. And then that system has already been adopted statewide for elections in Alaska and Maine, where it does seem to have generated moderation in, you know, sort of like Alaska, you know, elected a moderate Democrat in the last congressional election, despite the crazy Republican having a plurality in the sort of like the first round, right? The moderate Democrat like stole the election by having, you know, enough second place votes that she was able to win. And you know, when I say stole, I mean like stole in the good way, right? Like so stole in the, by design, by the design of the system. And so it makes like less crazy candidates, more likely to win. And then we've seen, you know, there's some cities that have already adopted that kind of method as well. So I think that, you know, that's not my, it's not my ideal system, but it's a step in the right direction for sure. And I think it would help, if we kind of did all like sort of statewide elections, that way, you'd get a lot more moderation in the long run across you know the entire spectrum. People would be rushing towards the center rather than rushing to stake out ground on the fringes.
All right, this brings me to my final question, and it's admittedly an open-ended one. There's a growing body of evidence to suggest that zero-sum thinking is especially demotivating and tends to produce lower rates of innovation in society. But in recent studies, in particular a new paper out of Harvard called Zero-Sum Thinking and the Roots of U.S. Political Divides, it's pointed out that the effects are self-reinforcing. Individuals who grow up in low-growth environments tend to have zero-sum mindsets as adults. The researchers were pretty clever in how they went about surfacing that pattern. They first tracked the GDP growth per capita that the survey respondents experienced before the age of 20, and then asked them a series of questions about opposing beliefs regarding things like wealth and hard work. So, people can only get rich at the expense of others versus wealth can grow, so there's enough for everyone. Or, success is mainly about luck versus success is mainly the result of hard work. What all this means is that as growth becomes more necessary, it also becomes harder to convince people that it's possible. It's a problem that you spend a lot of time thinking about, first through startups and now through research. But I wonder, at the level of culture, is there something you think we could be doing more of to reignite this appreciation for growth?
So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's an apt point. It's something I've been thinking a lot about. I've actually been writing a little bit about it. And just I'm very concerned that if we kind of let the stagnation drag on long enough, it's going to affect a positive sum attitudes and revert them to sort of zero sum attitudes, which are, after all, like the evolutionary norm, right? Like the norm that we evolved under was zero sum growth, and so those attitudes are very easy to lapse back into, and the dynamics in the paper that you cite are really interesting, because it's like you start out someplace and either you get growth forever or you get collapse, right? It's like so either the TFP goes to infinity or it goes to zero. And that's a scary thought when you think about, like, oh, we're actually might be having a surge in zero sum thinking. So what was the question again? I just went off on a tangent there.
No worries. It's culturally, how do you think we can address the problem?
Oh. Yeah, so culturally, I think the way to address it is creating elite consensus. So my sort of like three-part model of politics is as follows, right? So in the first instance, you have the median voter hypothesis, right? So if we're a democracy, if the voters really care about something, we're going to do what the voters want, right? And so if they care about some particular issue a lot, and it becomes like a culture war topic, or it becomes like a big thing that they care about, like Congress pretty much has to do what they want, and that's just like sort of the baseline, right? Now, interestingly, or maybe fortunately, like the median voter doesn't actually care about very much, right? Like they care about like a very, very limited subset of issues, like who's allowed to use what bathrooms, and like what are like overall tax rates, and a few other things. We have to do what the median voter wants on those issues. And then that still leaves like a lot of other space for other things to happen. And so then the question falls to like, well, what do elites believe? And I think if elites are divided, then, you know, sort of there's no unified position that the elites have, then special interests get what they want, right? So like the special interests, like the sort of like industry lobbyists or whatever, like they come in, they're like, you know what, like nobody cares about this. Just do what we want, because, and like, we're willing to invest the resources in educating you and telling you exactly what needs to happen and so on. And so they do what they want. I think in the other case where elites are basically unified, and it's basically like, look, we all think, you know, this is what needs to happen. And if you vote against it, like you're not coming to any of the parties, like, you know, like the members of Congress, like they're going to be pariahs from elite society. Like they basically do what the elites want. So I think if we like that's the median voter is never going to care about kind of TFP type arguments. And so what we have to do is the special interests are always going to lobby for what's in their interest. And so really the only alternative is to sort of create like elite consensus, I think, sort of in the way that, you know, like you, like we've had like victories in sort of like California YIMBY world, where they've had to be able to push a lot of reforms just because like there's elite consensus, like we need to build more housing. And so politicians find a way to do that. And so you need that for a bunch of issues besides housing, but also just the general idea of like, we need to be growing faster. And I think if we can move the needle on elite opinion and sort of get like consensus in society, like that's what we need to be focusing on. I think that's how you get the political branches to pay attention and start making the right decisions.
All right, great answer. Well, Eli, thank you so much for the time that you've given me today. Thank you for fighting the good fight, and thank you for having been a guest on this winter podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been really fun.